you've ever seen. I had to do something, right? So that's an F-15 at an air show. A lot of you deal with that vehicle or have dealt with that vehicle in the past, and with the new vehicles that are coming, the F-22 Raptor and the Joint Strike Fighter and a lot of different things, you test those out at AEDC. So a lot of you have been involved in those. Some of you were in the Air Force. Some of you have family and friends that were in the Air Force and that maybe worked on that vehicle or even flew that vehicle. We've got a local gentleman here, actually David, our boss. His son is a test pilot for the Air Force. And he grew up here in Coffee County, and he's a very highly recognized test pilot for the United States Air Force today. And so when I see that, it reminds me of the travels I get to make around the country, and I'm getting ready to leave again tomorrow, but the travels I get to make. And there's a sign as you approach some of our Air Force bases. And that sign, it's a billboard that's fairly common, and it says, "Pardon our noise, but this is the sound of freedom." Now, in our country, it doesn't resonate very well with us because most of us have not seen battles on our soil. I mean, I guess 9/11 comes the closest to us seeing something of a battle on our soil, an attack, if you will. But you go to Edwards Air Force Base, and you go to Langley Air Force Base up near Hampton, Virginia, and you go to several other Air Force bases, and that sign is prominent. Now, in the public sector, I remember in Memphis, several of several of my mother's family live in the Memphis area, and when Federal Express decided to move their operations, their hub, to Memphis, they bought neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood of homes and leveled the neighborhoods because the noise of the Federal Express vehicles taking off throughout the night to get the packages overnight where they needed to go was a bothersome noise. Well, this morning I had a conversation with David Bynum, and we both experienced a bothersome noise every once in a while in our life. David shared with me that there's been times where he has heard the words, "David Sumter Bynum," and he knows that's not a good thing. He actually said that there's one level beyond that. Now, see, for most of us, if our parent used our full name, now in David's case, in my case, in others probably, sometimes they called you the wrong name, but they knew it was one of you that they were trying to get after, right? But in David's case, he says he knew he was in trouble when he heard all three names, but if he ever heard his mother start in German, it was all over. And he couldn't even really tell me exactly what the words were, Marina, but he did tell me that it's something about thunderstorm. And she says, "That's right." So I don't know if it's a thunderstorm sticking to come down in your head or what it was, but he said that if he heard those words, all he knew was it was thunderstorm in German, and he was in big trouble. So we've all experienced that. So pardon that noise is the scary moment. Now, see, I'm adopted. And at 16 years old, when I was adopted, I got to change my name. That was a scary moment for my mother in the courtroom when the judge asked me if there's anything that I wanted to do, if I understood that my name was going to be Whittem now and so forth and so on. And I said, "Well, yeah, I've really never been called my real name all my life. I've been called Lee. But my given name, my birth name, was Byron." And that's not that I have anything against Byron, but I was a Byron Lee Skeen Jr. That was my given name. And my mother, even though I lived with my stepdad and her for more years than not, when my mother got really angry, she reverted back to the original birth name. I knew that I was probably going to lose a limb or something at that point in time. So we've all had those moments where a noise, if you will, or a shout or something comes to us that it literally can make us quake in our boots. Well, I want to talk this morning about some different noises that happened in the Old Testament. And some different things, and we're going to roll that to the New Testament to conclude our lesson. But if you, I guess I'm in control of this thing now, David. I was afraid because Ken said, "Don't touch that thing because you'll mess up our songs." And so songs are over, so now I can touch this thing, right? So the first piece, it starts in Numbers, and in Numbers, the 13th and 14th chapter, it's really the people of Israel have been wandering, and they've been through the desert, and they've gotten to the doorstep of the land of Canaan. They've gotten to the doorstep of the land of promise. And God has brought them there. Moses has led them there. And there's been all kinds of trials and tribulations through that process. And we know some of those. Well, when they get there, the first thing that happens is they decide that they need to send out some spies. And it was so funny this morning because Herd's question for the adult class in here was, who sent the spies? And I told him after class, I said, this is going to be really interesting because I'm going to have an answer. And we came up with three or four answers, I think, Herd, when we were just chatting about what he had and what I had and so forth. So if you look at that in the 13th chapter of Numbers, and I'm going to flip over there real quick in my Bible here. I'm wearing glasses because that way I can read. David asked me to read the other night, and I realized I'm getting old. I was reading in John, and I was having to move my Bible because the red letter edition didn't show up as well with my older eyes and the small print didn't show up as well. I guess that's a confession. So it says, the Lord said to Moses in verse 1, send some of the men to explore the land of Canaan, which I'm about to give the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders. So he's asked every tribe to name someone. And we know that there were 12, that were 12 tribes, and there were 12 men chosen, and the list of the names are there. And we know that there were two that came back with a report. And when the two came back with their report, they said, we can do this, and 10 said, no, we can't. Okay? And so they went through the process of who's for this and who's against this process or this taking of the land. And the people were incited, I guess, a little bit, and a little bit of a riot, if you will, not necessarily like we've been seeing on TV, I hope, but a little bit of a grumbling set about with the people, and the 10 that were not wanting to go tackle the giants in the land and the walled cities and all the things, they basically came forward and said, you know, we can't do this. And God gets angry with the people because he had no intention for them to do this. Every intention was for God to do this and for them to follow God, like they had done when they crossed the Red Sea, like they had done when they'd been in the desert, waiting to get into the land of promise. So the people grumble, God gets angry, and we know what ends up happening. God basically says, okay, all of you who grumbled, all of you except Joshua and Caleb, you're not going to see the promised land. I'm going to send you back out in the desert, and for the number of days that the people were exploring the land or they were spying out the land, which was 40, you're going to now have to go and spend 40 days or 40 years in the desert again, waiting for all of you to die, and the next generation will inherit the land. All except Joshua and Caleb. Additionally, something we don't really look at very much is if you look in chapter 14, about verses 36 and 38, it starts talking about what God does to those 10. And God literally deals with them right there on the spot. They didn't have to wait 40 years of wandering. He basically right then and there says, this is it. You guys are going to die now, and he sends a plague on those 10. And he takes care of business with those 10 right then and there because they disobeyed him and what he had asked them to do. So the people saw the plague happen to the 10, I'm assuming, and they start wondering and worrying about where they're going and what's going to happen, and now we've got to go out there and we're all going to die. And so the people decide that what they're going to do is they're going to go ahead and take the land anyway. And Moses says, don't do this. You will be defeated if you do this. And they go up and they battle and they're all defeated and they end up going out and having to do the wandering, just like God said they were going to have to do. So they have 40 years of wandering. All of them die except Joshua and Caleb and their families. So the noise of the grumbling of the people set God into motion a plan that it was not the original plan, but it was the result of their grumbling created a plan. So we've got a grumbling noise that happens with the people, and they end up deciding that, you know, God decides you're not going to go into the land anymore. The next thing that happens is they wander around for the 40 years, everybody dies, and they get to the doorstep again. So they're on the other side of Jordan, they're waiting to go in. Moses has died. Joshua has been named the leader of the people. And they're getting ready to go in, and you can see what it says here. in Joshua, the first chapter, it starts to talk and it says, hey, it's really cool. You can actually see that when you wear your glasses. I normally struggle with that thing. Whatever you have commanded us, we will do. And this is people talking to Joshua. And wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your word and does not obey your words, whatever you may command them, they will be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. Now, those words strong and courageous happen a lot throughout Joshua. But it's interesting to me that they say, we'll obey you just like we obeyed Moses. Now, I've read my history back in the Old Testament, and it doesn't seem like that's a true story of what happened. And then the other thing that's interesting to me is that it's this play on the words, but they say, your God. It's almost as if the people didn't have a relationship with God. Their relationship was through Joshua. And Joshua's relationship was what they were counting on to save them or get them to where they were going. So now there's more, if you will, more of a joyous. Some of the songs we sang this morning, I asked Tommy, I kind of told him where I was going, and he led us in some songs that were about shouting to God. And those were all praise type things. Sing to God, shout to God. David talks about in Psalms 100, shout to the Lord. And there are several other psalms that talk about those things. So this is a good now noise that the people are making. We're with you, Joshua. We're behind you. We want to do what God wants us to do. We want to go where he wants us to go. Well, if you look at Joshua and you flip over a few chapters to the second chapter of Joshua, Joshua decides that what he needs to do is he needs to send out two spies to spy out the land. And this is a famous story that we've all heard before. And in the second chapter of Joshua, they go out. And they especially are charged with inspecting Jericho. Really explore Jericho and let me know what the answer is. Let me know what you see. And so the spies go, and we know they get into the city of Jericho, and they go to the house of Rahab. And at the house of Rahab, the king sends men that there are Israelites in the land, and that and in his city specifically. And he wants them to be brought out, and Rahab says, they left. You know, I think they're probably already outside the walls of the city at this point, but they went this direction. If you want to go get them, you can probably make it and catch them. And they were, of course, hidden on the roof of Rahab's house. And when it was over, it's interesting what happens. So the first thing is the two spies go out, especially check out Jericho. Rahab protects the spies in verses 3 through 7. It's interesting to me that now is another noise that comes, if you'll let me use that a little bit. And that Rahab says before the Israelites and before God, I have a bargain for you. I protected you. I'll get you out of the city. But do not forget me. Do not forget my family when you come. Because we are shaking. We are fearful of what your God has done. We heard what your God did about crossing the Red Sea and what he did to the Egyptians. We've heard what you did to the kings on the other side of the Jordan. We've heard how you utterly destroyed nations through your God. Don't forget me. And a commitment's made by those two spies that if you'll do certain things, and this is the bargains accepted by the spies, if you do these certain things, you tie the red cord and in your window, and if you bring your family in your house will be spared. But if anybody is outside the house, it's on their head. It won't be our fault. And they go back and they report to Joshua of the conditions, and they tell Joshua, this is what we've done. And we can take the land. They're fearful of us. They are so afraid that their city is locked up, and when we were there, just two men, they were petrified, and they were trying to find us. And so at the end, as the report is given to Joshua, there at the end of that second chapter, basically the mission says, we can do this. They're petrified of us. They're shaking. They're quaking. We're ready to go. And then the next couple of chapters in Joshua is dealt with Joshua getting the people ready. There's not a lot that's said. It's a very short piece in there, a couple of chapters, there, but it talks about how he consecrated the people, and God said that you've had this whole new nation that's been with you in the desert, and they need to show the signs of being my people. And so he makes them go through the circumcision ritual out there in the desert before they're going to go into battle. And so they circumcise all of the males that are getting ready to go into battle there in the desert. And as they go through that process, they finish up, and they do that at a place called Gilgal, and they get ready to go into the land of Canaan. So they're ready to go. The fall of Jericho comes in the fifth chapter, at the very end of the fifth chapter, and I'm going to read that to you. What it says is, "Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and he saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked him, 'Are you for us or for our enemies?' 'Neither,' he replied, 'but as the commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come.' And Joshua fell down, he took off his sandals, and he said, I'm in a holy place.'" And they talked about what they were going to do. And then what ends up happening is the commander of God's army gives the direction. How you're going to go take this walled, fortified city of Jericho, and you're going to take it down. And it says, as you get into chapter 6, that the city was locked up. No one could come in and no one could go out. The people of Jericho were scared to death of the Israelites and what was going to happen and what was coming next for them. And so what he ends up doing is, he says, "I'm going to deliver the city." And in the second verse it says, "The Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with the king and all of his fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times. When the priests blowing the trumpets, when you hear them sound the long blast on the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the people will go up and every man will go straight in." So again, God has done all these miraculous things. And I didn't really talk about crossing the Jordan, but it was kind of similar to crossing the Red Sea. And God, you know, God holds the walls of, or holds the water back, and the whole nation crosses across the river, and they do all these miraculous things that the people have heard. So we get into the instruction for the battle. It's really not much of a battle plan, I guess, from our view. You know, we don't have any tanks and we don't have any aircraft and we don't have all these armies, although there were armed men, but all they were supposed to do was march around the wall of the city, and then so they do that. And for 6 days they follow the plan. They get the Ark of the Covenant out there, and the priests are out there with the horns, and they sound the horns, and they go around the city, and then they go back to camp. And I guess, you know, they do whatever several million people do in a camp. They probably had bonfires and made s'mores and, you know, waited for the next day. So the next day comes, day 2, and they go do the same thing again. And it just seems, you know, I can imagine if I were one of those people, what would I be thinking? I mean, I've heard the stories of how we went across the Red Sea. I've seen with my eyes how we crossed the Jordan River. I've seen manna from heaven. I've seen the quail. I've seen the water from the rock, or at least I've heard those stories. All these wonderful things. And God just wants us to walk around the city and blow a trumpet and then go sit down for a day and then come back and do it again. And we have to do it 6 times. What's the purpose? What's the point? You know, of course, the point is, this is the way God wanted it to be done. God was trying to make them recognize that it's going to be nothing out of what you do that is going to create this great city, this great walled city to fall, and for you to be able to take the land. It's going to be all about me, which is what his point was. So they get to day 6, and the same thing happens every day. And then, of course, day 7 comes along, and the plan is completed. On day 7, they march around the city 7 times, and they blow their trumpets. And at the end of the 7th circle around the city, and they blow the trumpets, all of the people gave a great shout, and the walls of the city fell. And everyone in the city was killed, with the exception of Rahab and her family. God's promise, or the promise of the spies, that they would keep the bargain. They kept the bargain. God kept the bargain, because God's the one who caused it to fall and crash around their ears. So this great shout. So we've had the people shouting to God because of who he was. We've had the people grumbling against God because of what they felt like he had done. You've brought us out of Egypt to die in the desert. You know, we've heard that several times through the Old Testament where they talk through those things. Well, what about us? If you flip to the 1 Corinthians, it talks about us. In the 13th chapter, and Jessica, you don't have to worry about this. I'm not going to try to ruin this for you, okay? Jessica White is going to get married this summer. And a lot of times, what do we think about this chapter? This is the love chapter. And it's quoted in a lot of weddings. I want to focus on just the first three verses. Listen to what they say. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I am only a sounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. If I give all that I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but I have not love, I gain nothing. I guess as I've been thinking about what to, you know, David asked me a month ago and if I would give another lesson, and you go through processes when you're in that mode. Some of you know that, and I came to this. I just kept coming back to these three verses, and yesterday was the last day of Upwards, and I've had I guess, Tim, you've given me the opportunity to referee some. I'm probably not a good referee. We got yelled at yesterday, Tim. We got called a foul, you know. So this was the first and second grade girls that we were getting yelled at. But we were out there with first and second grade girls, and the coaches came to me before the game, and to Chad Jacobs, who was reffing with me, and they said, we've got one little girl who's not scored a basket all year. And we've tried to figure out a way to get her the ball, and she just, you know, most of the time she can't get the ball up to the goal, and just we've tried. And so everyone on the court knew the goal. The goal was to get her to score a basket. So as we played the game, we got into the second half, and we got through the first 6 minutes, and we got into the second 6 minutes, and it was looking pretty gloomy that we weren't going to get there. Just didn't look like we were going to, because every time we got her the ball, she'd get down near the goal and she'd either dribble off her foot and it'd go out of bounds, or she'd dribble out of bounds, or she'd get behind the goal when she couldn't really get to the goal. So it kind of became this groundswell of the crowd and the kids on the floor and even the opposing team knew the goal. We finally got in the last 6 minutes. She got the ball, and she was dribbling down the court, and I was behind her, and I was encouraging her all the way down. She said, go to the basket, you know. And so I've got my whistle, and I'm sort of trying to talk through my whistle and get her down to there. So we get her down there, and she gets underneath the basket, and she looks up, and she literally is underneath the basket. I mean, she's looking up through the net, and everyone's, even the team, the opposing team is saying, shoot, shoot. And so she shoots, and the ball went up in the net and came back down. And Tommy was announcing, and he says, that's a minus two. And I said, no, it's not a minus two, because it has to go all the way through the goal and back down before it's minus two. So he put the points fictitiously back on the board. And so the next time she came down the court, and time is winding down, and she gets the ball, and it's like all the defense and all the offense move away from the goal, and she gets to the goal, and I could see Chad just smiling because she was back basically underneath the rim again, and we knew it wasn't going to be good. And so he's like, back up. You know, she's picked the ball up. She's not really supposed to move, as we all know the rules of basketball, but she takes a good 6 or 7 steps back to get in front of the goal. And we don't have any traveling because we didn't see that. You know, referees are blind anyway. That's what I learned yesterday. So she got back and she shot the ball, and the ball went up and it went back through the rim. And she'd made a shot. The entire crowd the entire 10 girls on the floor, the girls that were on the bench, the coaches, the referees, everyone there, there was a huge shout. And Tommy, you know, has a microphone, so he got to be louder than the rest of us. And he's like, "She scores!" You know, and it was just this huge celebration of what happened yesterday. Later, after that was over, evidently Nick wasn't in the gym at the time. He was back somewhere else. And he came out and he asked me, he says, what was that huge roar? Because he was just in the other room, but it's just behind that, you know, the door. And I said, oh, a little girl who hadn't scored all year finally scored her first basket. He said, oh, okay, that makes sense. He didn't know what had happened, but he heard the roar. He heard the sound. He heard the noise. There's good noises like that. There's tons of stories that we've got from upwards. I'm sure every one of you could do, coaches and folks that, you know, did whatever you could. You've got stories just that we could go on and on about. My concern as we close this morning is that, am I a resounding gong? There's a warning about how I speak to others, or the attitude I use, or the things I try to bind on someone else, that maybe I'm just nothing but a resounding gong. Maybe I'm causing people to stumble because of my attitude or because of my words or because of what I'm trying to bind on you. And we all, unfortunately, we're human and we stumble and we do those things. But I don't like the description of me being a resounding gong, because in God's word, that's not a good description. Well, the other one he says, or am I a clanging cymbal? Again, not really good connotations that go with God's word as he talks to us about not being. Because I'm not showing the kind of love, the kind of compassion that Christ showed if that's what I'm about. What I was asked to do by God, what you are asked to do by God, what Jesus came and gave us, was sometimes I need to be the whisper of God's love. I need to be about the whisper of His compassion. There are people that are hurting everywhere. You know them at work. You know them at the grocery store. You know them at church. You know them in any place that you go. We need to be about that piece of God's love. We need to be about the piece of us being God, us being Jesus, and using His noise, if you'll let me go there, the noise of His whisper, the noise of Him talking to the woman who's brought in front of Him and put at His feet, and He says, "Where's everybody? Where's all the commotion? How come everybody's left?" Using that Jesus, that compassion. Well, I forgive you, go. There's a whole message around the whisper of God to our hearts. We sang a song a little earlier, and it talked about the Lord is in His holy temple. When we sing that song, visions come to my mind. I don't know if they come to your mind. When I sing a song, I think of things, and I have a vision of God and things that, you know, that I think of. And we talk about the temple, sometimes I go to the temple. I literally go to the temple that I saw when I was in a grade school and they had the big temple and you know, the temple of God. Or I go to maps in the back of my book that shows the layout of the temple. But guys, when we're singing about the temple of God, when we say God's in His holy temple, that means God's in your heart. I mean, God is inside you, and what we're sharing and what we're giving to those around us, that's supposed to become God coming from our temple, from the temple of God, which is me, out to the people that I come in contact with. That's the message that He wants us to have. So there can be the great noise, the great shout of the celebration, There can be the great noise of the grumbling. And I think in those terms, when you go back to the people grumbling, that was that clanging cymbal. That was that gong that God was not interested in hearing. As we close this morning, I hope that what we can see is that we need to go out this week and the rest of our lives, if we can, and I know we're going to fall, we're going to stumble, we're going to mess up, and I'll be the first one to probably do it, you know, later today, I'll probably mess up. But we need to be about going out and showing the whisper of God's love. The noise that comes from us should be the noise of compassion and the noise of God's love, and not anything else. That's what we should be about. If you've struggled this week or your life, and you want some assistance from God, not from us, because I can't do anything for you. I mean, I can hug you, I can say, you know, I'll pray for you, but I really can't do anything for you. And neither can anybody else in this room, except that we can love you like God's told us to love you. But God's the one who does His miraculous healing. He's the one who's here for us. If you need Jesus, if you need God, if there's anything that our elders can pray for you about, if you'd come while we stand and sing.